greetings everyone and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest, and I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally on 29 AM and FM radio stations 7 days a week in the United States and in more than 70 countries worldwide on the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit my webpage, that's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events, so stay tuned for tonight's special report on the worst president in history, right after this message. Well, people call the law school regularly, and they ask how they can learn more about the topics that I speak on over the air. And every topic that I cover on the air, I teach in detail in one of my classes. And these classes are tailored for busy people in every walk of life, people just like you. For example, the origin of the common law. How is the common law applicable today? How do we use the common law in court, on the street, at home, or at work? Where did it come from, and of what value is it anyway, now in the modern 21st century? Well, the common law is important because it affects your status, and your status is how you're being taxed. And it's important because it affects your property or your lack of property. And this common law lesson is the first of 46 lessons in my tax and status school. We have three basic goals. The first is to stay out of jail. The second is to save your assets. And third is to solve your tax problem once and for all. Now, if you want to live your life peaceably and be left alone, this tax and status class is for you. You can write, call, or wire me, George Gordon, and ask for my free general law CD package, and I'll show you why the common law is so important to you and in so many different ways. Now, for more information about my tax and status school, just call and order the free general law CD package. That's a 4-hour commentary on the law in general. It's educational, it's informative, it's entertaining. Best of all, it's free of charge, and you can call direct 417-273-4967 to order yours. And my tax and status school is also available on compact disc for adult home study. If you're online, you can go to the website georgegordon.org, click onto the email machine, and send me an email request for the general law CD package. That's georgegordon.org or call direct 417-273-4967. Fahrenheit 9/11 tells essential truths about U.S. leaders who exploited national tragedy for political gain. It's a blockbuster documentary, and since it opened, Fahrenheit 9/11 has been a hit in both blue and red America, even at theaters close to military bases. Last Saturday, Dale Earnhardt Jr. took his NASCAR crew to see it, and the film's appeal to working-class Americans who are the true victims of George Bush's policies should give pause to its critics, especially the nervous liberals rushing to disassociate themselves from Michael Moore. There's been much tut-tutting by the pundits who complained that the movie, though it has yet to be caught in any major factual errors, uses association and innuendo to create false impressions. Many of these same pundits consider it bad form to make a big fuss about the Bush administration's use of association and innuendo to link the Iraq War to 9/11. Why hold a self-proclaimed filmmaker to a higher standard than you hold the President of the United States? And for all of its flaws, Fahrenheit 9/11 performs an essential service. It would be a better movie if it didn't promote a few unproven conspiracy theories, but those theories aren't the reason why millions of people who are not diehard Bush haters are flocking to see it. These people see the film to learn true stories they should have heard elsewhere, like Dan Rather and Tom Brokaw, but they didn't. Mr. Moore may not be considered respectable, but his film is a hit because the respectable media haven't been doing their job. For example, Audiences are shocked by the now famous 7 minutes when George Bush knew the nation was under attack, but continued reading My Pet Goat with a group of children. Nobody had told them that the tales of Mr. Bush's decisiveness and bravery on that day were pure fiction. Or consider the Bush family's ties to the Saudis. The film suggests that Mr. Bush and his good friend Prince Bandar bin Sultan, the ambassador known to the family as Bandar Bush, have tried to cover up the extent of Saudi involvement in terrorism. Well, this may or may not be true, but what shocks people, I think, is the fact that nobody told them about this side of Mr. Bush's life. Now, Mr. Bush's carefully constructed persona is that of an all-American regular guy, not like his suspiciously cosmopolitan opponent with his patrician air. The news media have cheerfully gone along with the pretense, and how many stories have you seen contrasting John Kerry's upper crusty vacation on Nantucket with Mr. Bush's down-home time at the ranch? But the reality revealed by Mr. Moore is that Mr. Bush has always lived in a bubble of privilege, and his family, far from consisting of regular folks with deep roots in the heartland, is deeply enmeshed financially and personally with foreign elites, with the Saudis in particular. And Mr. Moore's greatest strength is a real empathy with working-class Americans that most journalists lack. Having stripped away Mr. Bush's common man mask, he uses his film to make the case in a way that statistics never could, that Mr. Bush's policies favor a narrow elite at the expense of less fortunate Americans, sometimes indeed at the cost of their lives. Now, no one can accuse documentarian and bedraggled, beer-bellied gadfly Michael Moore of having a hidden agenda. He has raised a firestorm of controversy and generated a torrent of publicity, not only by bludgeoning President Bush with his feature-length attack, Fahrenheit 9/11, but also by declaring that he made the film in hopes of booting Bush from office. In the end, he isn't likely to affect the presidential race, but Fahrenheit 9/11 may have an altogether different effect, a change in the practice and the values of journalists and journalism. What Moore and the film have done is to take dead aim on one of the most sacred of journalistic books or ideas, the idea that journalists are supposed to be fair and balanced. This isn't just a function of Moore having a point of view to push. There have always been provocateurs. Rather, it is a function of the film revealing the harm that balance has done to our public discourse and the distortions that it has promoted. The words fair and balanced have been largely discredited in recent years because of the Fox News Channel, which uses them to mean not that Fox takes an objective, even-handed approach to the news, but that the cable channel is redressing the purported liberal bias of the mainstream news media, balancing them out, in effect. But leaving Fox aside, the idea of fair and balanced is still a mainstay of most journalistic practice, well, at least in theory. Reporters are not supposed to take sides. For every pro on one side of the scale, there must be a con on the other. If the 9/11 Commission declares that there's absolutely no credible evidence of any collaborative relationship between Saddam Hussein and Al-Qaeda, the press must also prominently post Vice President Dick Cheney's view that there was a relationship, whether he provides evidence of that relationship or not. Now, if the preponderance of scientific evidence or scientific opinion says that global warming threatens the environment, the press must still interview the handful of scientists who dismiss it as nonsense. Now, that's just the way it is. And then, into this staid and carefully counterpoised media culture came Michael Moore, who chortled on The Daily Show recently that he was unfair and unbalanced. But he was only half right. Obviously, Fahrenheit 9/11 is not balanced in its approach to Bush. There are no Bush spokesmen giving the Bush spin or the Bush point of view. But by the same token, virtually every factual statement in the film, as distinguished from Moore's interpretation of those facts, is accurate, true, and correct. In short, the film isn't balanced, but it may be fair. Now, even before Fox appropriated them, the words fair and balanced had been yoked as if they were somehow synonymous. But if by fair one means objective and unbiased, then more often than not, fair and balanced may be mutually exclusive. Now, to cite one glaring example of just how balance can transmogrify into unfairness, there's a story of a television host who once invited a Holocaust historian, Deborah Lipstadt, on his program and then had a Holocaust denier as a counterweight, implying that the two sides were equally credible. Now, it should come as no surprise that conservatives have increasingly relied on this little journalistic loophole. They have come to realize that they can do all sorts of things, the more egregious the better, and the press will not call them out because balance, if not fairness, requires that the press not seem to be piling on or taking one side against the other. So the Bush administration can fashion a prescription drug program that is a shameless giveaway to the pharmaceutical industry, or continue to insist that the war in Iraq is the front line in the war on terror, knowing full well that the press will not report a giveaway as a giveaway or a trumped-up link to terror as a trumped-up link without also giving at least equal measure to the administration's own spin, even if it is demonstrably false. Lying is not against the law in the news. Now, at the same time, the adherence to balance that has so clearly aided conservatives has made liberals seem like the hapless fellow in a science fiction movie, who keeps trying to convince everyone that the kindly new neighbors are actually aliens, only to be dismissed as a paranoid. Take Bill Clinton, for instance. However one may feel about Clinton, it was perfectly obvious that the right had conspired to gang up on him, just as he and Hillary said, though the press shrugged off the charge. After all, to privilege it wouldn't have been balanced. In noisily forswearing balance for genuine fairness, Moore has shamed an American press corps that, for fear of offending conservatives, refused to report what Moore was now reporting. Everything from the cursory interviews the FBI conducted with members of Osama bin Laden's family in America before letting them leave, to the eagerness of big business in exploiting Iraq, to the astonishing fact that only one of the 535 members of Congress has a child serving in the military in Iraq. And that shame, added to the film's success, may be the reason why Michael Moore has not been summarily dismissed by the mainstream media as a left-wing shill. Well, hang on. We'll take a break right here. We'll be back with more right after this. All right, you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week in the United States and worldwide on the Internet. For more information about the Gordon Law School and the Law Hour, please go to the website at georgegordon.org. The Law School teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school and is open to individuals by prearrangement only. The Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. For more information, go to the homeschooling page on the website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour is carried worldwide on the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest, and the Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, news, and current events 7 days a week. Tonight's program, The Worst President of the United States. Who is it? Is it George W. Bush? Well, the following appeared in the Durham, North Carolina local paper as a letter to the editor. We should forward to all of your list as this will put things in perspective. Keep in mind the phrase, never attacked us, refers to our homeland. The term, never attacked us, refers to the United States of America. Liberals claim that President Bush shouldn't have started this war, and they complain about his prosecution of it. One liberal recently claimed that George Bush was the worst president in American history. So let's clear up one point. President Bush did not start the war on terror. Try to remember back to 9/11. It was started by terrorists. But it was started by terrorists long before 9/11. So let's look at the worst president and the mismanagement claims. Franklin D. Roosevelt led us into World War II. Germany never attacked us. Japan did. From 1941 through 1945, 450,000 lives were lost during World War II. Now that's an average of 112,500 dead Americans per year. Harry Truman finished that war and then started a new one in Korea. North Korea never attacked us. From 1950 through 1953, 55,000 lives were lost in Korea. Now that's an average of 18,333 per year. John F. Kennedy started the Vietnam conflict, or America's involvement in it, in 1962. Vietnam never attacked the United States. Lyndon Johnson turned the Vietnam War into a quagmire from 1965 to 1975. 58,000 American lives were lost. That's an average of 5,800 per year. Bill Clinton went to war in Bosnia without United Nations or French consent. Bosnia never attacked the United States. He was offered Osama bin Laden's head on a platter 3 times by Sudan and did nothing. Are we complaining about President Bush and his failure to capture Osama bin Laden when Bill Clinton failed when he was offered to him? Osama bin Laden has attacked us on multiple occasions. Over 2,900 lives were lost on 9/11. And in the 2 years since terrorists attacked us, George Bush and the Republicans have liberated 2 countries, crushed the Taliban, crippled Al-Qaeda, put nuclear inspectors into Libya, Iran, and North Korea without firing a shot, captured a terrorist who slaughtered 300,000 of his own people. We lost 600 soldiers. That's an average of 300 a year. Bush did all of this abroad while not allowing another terrorist attack at home. President Bush, the worst president in history? Come on, boys and girls. The Democrats are complaining about how long the war is taking. But it took less time to take Iraq than it took Janet Reno to take the Branch Davidian compound in Texas. That was a 51-day operation. And we've been looking for evidence of chemical weapons in Iraq for less time than it took Hillary Clinton to find the Rose Law firm billing records. Remember? And it took less time for the 3rd Infantry Division and the Marines to destroy the Medina Republican Guard than it took Ted Kennedy to call the police after his Oldsmobile sank at Chappaquiddick. It took less time to take Iraq than it took to count the votes in Florida. President Bush, the worst president in history? Now, we're told that President Bush is bad. Let me see if I've got this straight. Bill Clinton awards Halliburton a no-bid contract in Yugoslavia. That's good. George Bush awards Halliburton a no-bid contract in Iraq, but that's bad. Bill Clinton spent $77 billion on war in Serbia, and that was good. George Bush spent $87 billion in Iraq, and that's bad. Bill Clinton imposed regime change in Serbia, and that was good. But George Bush imposes regime change in Iraq, and that's bad. Bill Clinton bombs Christian Serbs on behalf of Muslim Albanian terrorists, and that was good. George Bush liberated 25 million from genocidal dictator Saddam Hussein, but that was bad. Bill Clinton bombs the Chinese embassy. That was good. George Bush bombs terrorist camps. And that's bad. Bill Clinton commits felonies while in office, and that's good. George Bush lands on an aircraft carrier in a jumpsuit, but that's bad. Bill Clinton says that mass graves in Serbia are good. The entire world says weapons of mass destruction in Iraq is bad. The stock market crashes in 2000 under Bill Clinton, but Bill Clinton was a good president. The resulting recession under George Bush is bad, and it's all his fault. Bill Clinton refuses to take custody of Osama bin Laden. That was a good decision. But when the World Trade Centers fall under George Bush, George Bush is bad. He should have known what bin Laden was up to. Bill Clinton calls for regime change in Iraq. That's good. George Bush imposes regime change in Iraq, but that's bad. Terrorist training in Afghanistan under Bill Clinton was good. George Bush destroys the training camps in Afghanistan, but that's bad. No mass graves were found in Serbia. Well, that's good. No weapons of mass destruction were found in Iraq, but that's bad. Milosevic in custody, on trial, that's good. Saddam Hussein in custody, awaiting trial, that's bad. George Bush, the worst president in history. Now, George Bush may not be the best guy that ever occupied the White House, but some of the criticism of George Bush is short-sighted, to say the least. If you really believe that President Bush lied that there never were any weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, and that George Bush took us to war solely for his oil buddies, then let's read this, and if you're a fair-minded person, let's pass it on to your friends and your neighbors. One way or another, here's a direct quote from President Bill Clinton on February the 4th, 1998. Bill Clinton said this. He said, quote, "One way or other, we are determined to deny Iraq the capacity to develop weapons of mass destruction and the missiles to deliver them. That is our bottom line." February 4th, 1998. President Bill Clinton, a few days later, on February the 17th, 1998, had this to say. He said, "If Saddam rejects peace and we have to use force, our purpose is clear. We want to seriously diminish the threat posed by Iraq's weapons of mass destruction program." Unquote. President Clinton, February 17th, 1998. Now, Madeleine Albright, the Secretary of State, on February the 18th, 1998, just the day after President Bill Clinton made that famous statement, said, quote, "Iraq is a long way from the United States, but what happens there matters a great deal here, because the risks that the leaders of a rogue state will use nuclear, chemical, or biological weapons against us or our allies is the greatest security threat that we face." Madeleine Albright, February 18th, 1998. Now, Sandy Berger is the Clinton National Security Advisor. That same day, February the 18th, 1998, here's what Sandy Berger had to say. He said he, referring to Saddam Hussein, will use those weapons of mass destruction again, as he has 10 times since 1983. Sandy Berger, Clinton, National Security Advisor, February 18th, 1998. "We urge you, after consulting with Congress and consistent with the United States Constitution and laws, to take necessary actions, including, if appropriate, air and missile strikes on suspect Iraqi sites, to respond effectively to the threat posed by Iraq's refusal to end its weapons of mass destruction programs." Unquote. Who do you think said that? That was a letter to President Bill Clinton, signed by Senator Carl Levin, Tom Daschle, and John Kerry, among others, on October the 9th, 1998. Now, Saddam Hussein has been engaged in the development of weapons of mass destruction technology, which is a threat to countries in the region, and he has made a mockery of the weapons inspection process. That was Representative Nancy Pelosi, Democrat of California. She said that on December the 16th, 1998. And remember that she is the Democratic whip in the House. She's the majority, the minority leader in the House. Saddam Hussein has chosen to spend his money on building weapons of mass destruction and palaces for his cronies. So said Madeleine Albright, Secretary of State under the Clinton, or in the Clinton administration, on November the 10th, 1999. Now, I'm going to take a break here, and we'll come back, and I'm going to show you some more. I mean, if we're going to blame President Bush for claiming that war with Iraq over weapons of mass destruction was necessary and imperative, and then didn't find him and blame him for lying, what about the Clinton administration? Stand by. All right, you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Americans today are interrogated, watched, measured, and counted more than at any time in our history. Surveillance and electronic record keeping of nearly every routine activity from bank deposits to medical visits has produced greater efficiency and security, all right. But it's also responsible for a very discernible erosion of our ability to live our lives free from outside scrutiny. The federal government currently maintains an average of 15 files on every American, according to estimates by the Office of Management and Budget. And closer to home, state and local governments use computers to keep their own files on us. A study conducted by the New York Committee on Open Government found that that state, New York, and its agencies operated 1,776 separate data systems containing 10,799 categories of information about New York residents. And every one of those systems contained between 2 and 10 million records. Now, information about you and about me is gained from 63 sources, and this information is gathered and stored in a very reasoned and very logical manner for later retrieval and use. Now, would you like to know how government, banking, insurance, business, and industry obtains all of this information about you? What are their sources? How is it stored? How is it retrieved? What do they want it for, anyway? Well, knowing how this information is gathered and what information is stored and what information you want to keep personal and private actually puts you in the driver's seat in your quest for privacy. For more information about privacy and privacy issues, why don't you call the law school direct, 417-273-4967, and be sure to ask for my free general law CD package. And let me tell you how to train yourself to be just as personal and private as you want to be. It's educational, it's informative, it's entertaining, and best of all, it's free of charge, and you can call right now. That number again, 417-273-4967 to order yours. If you're online, just go to the website, send me an email, that's georgegordon.org, click onto the email machine, and then send your email request. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, or call direct 417-273-4967. All right, we're looking at the worst president in history. It's alleged to be George W. Bush. So, I'm going over a list of direct quotations that come from the Clinton administration while Bill Clinton was in office concerning George Bush and, Saddam Hussein and weapons of mass destruction that George Bush is alleged to have lied to us about. Now, I'm not telling you that George Bush didn't lie to us. But if George Bush lied to us, so did Bill Clinton, Madeleine Albright, and the Democratic administration under the Clintons during the Clinton years. And if we're going to be fair and balanced in our reporting, shouldn't we report the Clinton lies at the same time we report the Bush lies? And that, of course, is presuming that George Bush knew that there were no weapons of mass destruction in Iraq when he went to war. I haven't heard anybody come up with any evidence as to what he knew or didn't know concerning weapons of mass destruction. But the Democrats, including Bill Clinton, Madeleine Albright, Nancy Pelosi, Sandy Berger, all believed that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction back in 1998, 1999, and 2000. Now listen to this. In a letter to President Bush, signed by Senator Bob Graham, a Democrat from Florida, and others on December the 5th, 2001, here's what Senator Bob Graham said. He said, quote, "There is no doubt that Saddam Hussein has invigorated his weapons program. Reports indicate that biological, chemical, and nuclear programs continue apace and may be back to pre-Gulf War status. In addition, Saddam continues to redefine delivery systems and is doubtless using the cover of illicit missile program to develop longer range missiles that will threaten the United States and our allies," unquote. signed by Senator Bob Graham, Democrat of Florida, and others, December 5, 2001. And listen to this quotation. "We begin with the common belief that Saddam Hussein is a tyrant and a threat to the peace and the stability of the region. Hussein has ignored the mandate of the United Nations and is building weapons of mass destruction and the means of delivering them," unquote. Senator Carl Levin, Democrat of Michigan, September 19th, 2002. Al Gore got in on the act. Al Gore said, "We know that he has stored secret supplies of biological and chemical weapons throughout his country," unquote. Vice President Al Gore said that September 23rd, 2002. Al Gore said this, "Iraq's search for weapons of mass destruction has proven impossible to deter, and we should assume that it will continue for as long as Saddam is in power," unquote. Al Gore, September 23rd, 2002. "And we have known for many years that Saddam Hussein is seeking and developing weapons of mass destruction," unquote. Who said that? Senator Ted Kennedy, Democrat of Massachusetts, on September 27th, 2002. Then there's Senator Robert Byrd, the venerable old senator from West Virginia, the grand old man of the Senate. "The last UN weapons inspectors left Iraq in October of 1998. We are confident that Saddam Hussein retains some stockpiles of chemical and biological weapons and that he has since embarked on a crash course to build up his chemical and biological warfare capabilities. Intelligence reports indicate that he is seeking nuclear weapons." Senator Robert Byrd, Democrat of West Virginia, said that on October the 3rd, 2002. Senator John F. Kerry, now running for president against President Bush, said, quote, "I will be voting to give the President of the United States the authority to use force, if necessary, to disarm Saddam Hussein because I believe that a deadly arsenal of weapons of mass destruction in his hands is a real and a grave threat to our security," unquote. Senator John F. Kerry, Democrat of Massachusetts, said that on October the 9th, 2002. And then Senator Jay Rockefeller, another Democrat from West Virginia, said there is unmistakable evidence that Saddam Hussein is working aggressively to develop nuclear weapons and will likely have nuclear weapons within the next 5 years. We also should remember that we have always underestimated the progress that Saddam has made in development of weapons of mass destruction, unquote. Senator Jay Rockefeller, Democrat of West Virginia, October the 10th, 2002. And then Senator Representative Henry Waxman, Democrat of California, had this to say, quote, "He has systematically violated over the course of the past 11 years every significant UN resolution that has demanded that he disarm and destroy his chemical and biological weapons and any nuclear capacity. This he has refused to do," unquote. Representative Henry Waxman, Democrat of California, said that on October the 10th, 2002. Now, all of these Democrats believed that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction. Where did they get their information? Why didn't they tell us back in 2002, 2000, 1999, and 1998 that it was all a lie, that Saddam Hussein didn't have weapons of mass destruction, that this was some kind of a right-wing conspiracy on the part of radical Republicans seeking a personal agenda to attack Iraq? I never heard anything like that, did you? Now, I want to emphasize, boys and girls, that I'm not voting in the upcoming election. I am politically competent. and I don't need a politician to represent my political, my social, or my economic needs in any government. So I'm not beating the gong for President Bush or Ralph Nader or anybody else. I'm not opposed to John Kerry. I'm a neutral. I'm not going to vote. I'm one of those undecideds. I wouldn't vote for Kerry or Bush or Ralph Nader. In fact, I'm not going to. I'm not going to vote between or among the red death pill, the green death pill, and the blue death pill. But if we're going to be fair and unbiased, if we're going to make documentary movies, and if we're going to say Fahrenheit 9/11 is true, accurate, and correct, and that there are no factual errors, it's a lie. And as old Mark Twain used to say, there are lies, damn lies, and statistics. And Fahrenheit 9/11 is a damn lie. And here's why. Fahrenheit 9/11 doesn't go through these kinds of quotations from Democrats who all believed that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction. But he's clear, cogent, and careful to point out that President Bush lied to us and deceived us into believing that there was weapons of mass destruction in Saddam Hussein's Iraq, and that's why he lied to us and took us to war. You see, there are lies, and then there are lies by omission. I don't know, Michael Moore might be a nice guy, and maybe he just didn't know about these statements made by these Democrats. 1998, 1999, 2000, 2001, 3 years. 3 years before the war with Iraq. Excuse me, 3 years before 9/11. And 4 years before we went to war with Iraq. These prominent Democrats, did you get their names? Al Gore, Senator Carl Levin, Ted Kennedy, Robert Byrd, John Kerry, Jay Rockefeller, Henry Waxman, Bill Clinton, Madeleine Albright, Sandy Berger, Nancy Pelosi, all believed, along with Bob Graham and many other prominent Democrats, that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction, and were clearly on the record before George Bush was ever nominated, run for, or elected president of the United States. And now we're going to put out a documentary and say George Bush lied to us about weapons of mass destruction? No, there was more said about Saddam Hussein's weapons of mass destructions by the Democrats than I have ever heard by the Republicans. Now, I'm not a Republican, and I'm not beating George Bush's gong over here. But again, as a journalist, I watch Tom Brokaw and the news media, you know, Peter Jennings and Dan Rather, and the Lair News Hour, and across our desk and through our web service and wire service, you know, we get these news stories in here, and I'm listening to the quotations. I see the quotations. I see the standards that are being applied to George Bush that are patently false. Patently false, and I'm going to report them just that way. Now, you can decide for yourself who you want to vote for. I don't need to tell you how to vote, but I think you got to have all the facts, don't you? Stand by. All right, you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-sectarian law school and is open to individuals by prearrangement. The Law Hour website is updated weekly and has our radio log, schedule, and archives, and it can be accessed through the website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour is carried worldwide on the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest, and the Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, news, and current events, and we do it 7 days a week. The Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. To order yours, just call direct 417-273-4967. Again, that's 417-273-4967. The worst president of the United States. Here's a quotation from Senator Hillary Clinton. Hillary said, "In the 4 years since the inspectors left, intelligence reports show that Saddam Hussein has worked to rebuild his chemical and biological weapon stock, his missile delivery capability, and his nuclear program. He has also given aid, comfort, and sanctuary to terrorists, including Al-Qaeda members, and it is clear, however, that if left unchecked, Saddam Hussein will continue to increase his capacity to wage biological and chemical warfare and will keep trying to develop nuclear weapons." Senator Hillary Clinton said that October the 10th, 2002. "We are in possession of what I think to be compelling evidence that Saddam Hussein has, and has had for a number of years, a developing capacity for the production and storage of weapons of mass destruction." Senator Bob Graham, Democrat of Florida, December 8, 2002. "Without question, we need to disarm Saddam Hussein. He is a brutal, murderous dictator leading an oppressive regime. He presents a particularly grievous threat because he is so consistently prone to miscalculation. And now he is miscalculating America's response to his continued deceit and his consistent grasp for weapons of mass destruction. So the threat of Saddam Hussein with weapons of mass destruction is real." Senator John F. Kerry, Democrat of Massachusetts, January the 23rd, 2003. So now these same Democrats say that President Bush lied and that there never were any weapons of mass destruction. I don't know if you want to call that hypocrisy or forked tongue or lying deception. You know, you can hang whatever label on it that you want to. But those are the facts and those are the quotations. Now, George Bush, as the chief executive officer of the United States, has a duty to do the best he can with the information that he's got. Now, the Halliburton Company took a no-bid contract in Iraq. Now, it would seem like to me, I'm going to read you a story here, "Trucks made to drive without cargo in dangerous areas of Iraq." Listen to this. "Trucks are made to drive without cargo in dangerous areas of Iraq." This is posted Friday, May 21st, 2004. "Empty flatbed trucks crisscrossed Iraq more than 100 times as their drivers and the soldiers who guarded them dodged bullets, bricks, and homemade bombs. 12 current and former truck drivers who regularly made the 300-mile resupply run from Camp Cedar in southern Iraq to Camp Anaconda near Baghdad told Knight Ritter that they risked their lives driving empty trucks while their employer, a subsidiary of Halliburton Incorporated, billed the government for hauling what they derisively called sailboat fuel. Defense Department records show that Kellogg Brown and Root, a Halliburton subsidiary, has been paid $327 million for theater transportation of war material and supplies for U.S. forces in Iraq and is earmarked to be paid $230 million more. The convoys are a lifeline for U.S. troops in Iraq, hauling tires for Humvees, Army boots, filing cabinets, tools, engine parts, and even an unmanned Predator reconnaissance airplane. Kellogg Brown and Root's contract with the Defense Department allows the company to pass on the cost of the transportation and then add 1% to 3% for profit. But neither KBR nor the U.S. Army Field Support Command in Rock Island, Illinois, which oversees this contract, was able to provide cost estimates for the empty trucks. Trucking experts estimate that each round trip costs taxpayers thousands of dollars. 7 of the 12 truckers who talked to Knight Ritter asked that they not be identified by name. 6 of the 12 were fired by KBR for allegedly running Iraqi drivers off the road when they attempted to break into the convoy. The drivers disputed that accusation. In addition to interviewing the drivers, Knight Ritter reviewed KBR records of the empty trips. Dozens of photographs of empty flatbeds and a videotape that showed 15 empty trucks in one convoy. The 12 drivers, all interviewed separately over the course of more than a month, told similar stories about their trips through hostile territory. Thor, a driver who quit KBR and got his nickname for using a hammer to fight off a knife-wielding Iraqi who tried to climb into the cab of his truck, said his doctor recently told him he might lose the use of his right eye after a December attack. Iraqis shattered his windshield with machine gun fire. Bullets whizzed by his ear. Glass got into his eye and he broke two bones in his shoulder. His truck was empty at the time. I thought to myself, what good is this, he recalled. Shane Nitro Ratliff of Ruby, South Carolina, who quit working for KBR in February, recalled a harrowing trip in December. As he was hauling an empty truck to Baghdad International Airport, Iraqis threw spikes under his tires, and a brick, a cement-like clot of sand and gasoline through his windshield, scattering shards of glass all over him and into his eyes. We didn't have any weapons. We had two rocks and a can of ravioli to fight with, Ratliff said. Ratliff caught up with his fleeing convoy in his damaged truck and made it to the airport safely. He figured that he'd pick up a load there, but he was told to return with another empty trailer. Iraqi insurgents have killed 2 civilian drivers. Kellogg Brown and Root, the army and truckers, give different reasons for why empty trucks are driven through the areas that the drivers nicknamed Rockville and Slaughterhouse for the dangers they presented. Some of the truckers charge that KBR is billing the Pentagon for unnecessary work. KBR described the practice as normal, given the large number of trucks it has delivering goods throughout Iraq. Army officials said larger convoys may provide better security. The Army's contract with KBR calls for daily truck runs, but doesn't dictate how many trucks must be in a convoy or whether they must be full. So said Linda Thies, a spokeswoman for the U.S. Army Field Support Command in Rock Island, Illinois. The area military commander, or KBR officials, might choose to run empty trucks as a security measure, she said. KBR denied that there was any problem with the truck runs. KBR is proud of the work that we do for the military in Iraq. It is difficult and dangerous work and requires a lot from our employees, said Kathy Gist. She's a KBR spokeswoman. Kellogg Brown and Root truckers say that they can earn about $80,000 a year, which is tax-free, if they remain in Iraq for 1 year. The empty trailer runs in Iraq peaked in January, February, and March of this year, but have dwindled as violence has escalated and forced contractors to reduce the number of trucks in each convoy and how far they travel, the driver said. Earlier this year, as many as a third of all of the flatbed trucks in a 30-truck convoy were empty. Much of the time, drivers would drop off one empty trailer and pick up another empty for the return trip. There was one time we ran 28 trucks. One trailer had one pallet. A trailer can hold as many as 26 4-foot square pallets, and the rest of them were empty, said David Wilson, who was the convoy commander on more than 100 runs. Four other drivers who were with Wilson confirmed his account. James Warren of Rutherfordton, North Carolina, one of the fired KBR drivers, said that he drove empty trucks through Iraq more than a dozen times. Besides the risks to the truckers, the six National Guard or Army escorts who provided security were also in danger, he said. The KBR driver who shot the videotape of the 15 empty trailers on the road in January described it this way. This is just a sample of the empty trailers that we're hauling called a sustainer. And there's more behind me. There's another one right there. This is fraud and abuse right there. Well, now, if George Bush were doing his job, if George Bush were, in fact, a CEO, and if, as the CEO, this came to his attention, don't you think that it should be corrected? If I were the boss, and it came to my attention that the Halliburton Company and Brown & Root were stealing from us under the terms of our contract, even though the contract may not specify that trucks need to be loaded, common sense would tell you that when you move a truck, now maybe the trucks want to come back empty. I'm not suggesting that the truck from Baghdad back down to Kuwait would be loaded. But every truck from Kuwait north ought to be loaded, don't you think? Especially since they're collecting on these empty runs and they're delivering empty trailers from Kuwait to Baghdad and then picking up another empty trailer and driving it back. If I found that out in my company, I would fire somebody. I would change contractors. I would take control and take charge and correct that abuse. Now, I don't know that abuse has been corrected, but George Bush is the CEO, and George Bush or Donald Rumsfeld or somebody should correct that and eliminate that fraud and abuse. Now, there's something that George Bush ought to be criticized for, but not for believing that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction. All right, we're about done. These politically incorrect opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone, and they do not necessarily represent the beliefs and the opinions of the advertisers, sponsors, staff, or management of the network or of this radio station. Now, for more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, just go to the website georgegordon.org or call the Law School direct at 417-273-4967. All right, you've been listening to the Law Hour and editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. For more information about the Gordon Law School and Law Hour, please go to the website, georgegordon.org. The Law Hour is carried worldwide on the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Well, there's the signal that says my time is up, so we got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station, of course, God willing. So until then, good night, friends.